Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Today I want to begin talking about harmlessness. A famous passage from the Dhammapada goes like this. Refraining from every evil, accomplishing good, purifying the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. Seeing his complete awakening through meditation as the Buddha's greatest accomplishment, we often fail to recognize how thoroughly Buddhism is about ethics or virtue or morality. The Buddhist path creates saints before it creates awakened ones. Buddhism begins with ethics, and ethics provides the foundation for advanced teachings. Buddhist children learn generosity and harmlessness from toddlerhood. Ethics provides the foundations without which higher development of the mind is unattainable. Without the perfection of virtue, awakening is impossible. Starting with ethics, we most easily come to understand the logic of the entire Buddhist path, including that of meditation and of awakening. The opening verse from the Dhammapada gets to the heart of Buddhist ethics. It enumerates the three distinct but interrelated systems of Buddhist virtue. Refraining from every evil involves behaving harmlessly according to Buddhist ethical codes or precepts, which define norms of appropriate behavior. This is the topic of the present talk, as well as the talk next week. Accomplishing good is acting in ways that produce beneficial consequences for others. This is generosity and was the topic of the last two talks. Purifying the mind is the most characteristically Buddhist of the three, and it makes a virtue not only something we do in the world, but something integral to who we are and the way we think and respond. This will be the topic of the following two talks. The three in Buddha's teachings are mutually constraining and mutually supporting, like the legs of a tripod. The primary motivating principle of refraining from evil is harmlessness, ahimsa. The Sanskrit word for this has become well known in the English language, ahimsa, generally associated with Mahatma Gandhi and often translated as nonviolence. Although generosity, that is being of benefit, would seem to reach farther than simply not being of harm, living harmlessly is actually a great challenge. Without ethical standards, most people cause great harm almost daily, through physical injury, deception, betrayal, discord, and exploitation. Nonetheless, the practice of refraining from evil can much more effectively be reduced to a set of practical rules. In a way, generosity, because of its open-endedness, generally cannot. Refraining from evil is also sometimes described as a specific practice of generosity in itself, for when we are harmless, we thereby give others the gift of freedom from fear, specifically freedom from fear of us. We become a refuge. Precepts. Harm is also easier to track than benefit, whereas benefit in principle involves a weighing and predicting of future conditions. Harmfulness is generally an immediate quality of particular types of action. For instance, killing harms the object of the killing almost regardless of what other circumstances obtain. For this reason, limiting harm or avoiding evil can quite effectively be reduced to prohibitive rules of thumb, which we call precepts, sikkhapada in Buddhism. The Pali word sila is also used, especially in its plural form, silani, to refer to precepts, although sila also refers to behavior in general. Buddhist precepts are similar to the Ten Commandments of the Bible, or to traffic laws, or to the bothersome things your parents told you to do when you were a kid, like not watch more than 7 hours of TV a day or not to eat the dog's food. They're also comparable to professional rules of ethics, such as those observed by psychotherapists, not sleeping with clients, or members of the scientific community, not falsifying data. They're almost invariably, in early Buddhism, stated as abstentions, things not to do, for instance, do not kill rather than protect life, which is why they may be described with the phrase, to refrain from every evil. Traditionally, lay people throughout the Buddhist world have observed and routinely recite as a reminder at least the following five precepts since the time of the Buddha. 1. I undertake the precept to refrain from assaulting living things. This translates literally from attacking breath, breathing things. Panatipata. Killing or bodily harm is not limited to humans, but includes even snakes and insects. It thereby covers in itself a huge swath of our options for causing harm and regulates our most violent tendencies. 2. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking what is not given. This prohibits stealing. We practice this so that others will have a car to drive to work the next day, or something to eat when they get home that evening, or something to write with if they need to jot something down. Also, so they will not need a security system or a guard dog. 3. I undertake the precept to refrain from committing sensual misconduct. Sensual misconduct has primarily to do with sexual relations. The primary example is adultery, which is to say having extra sexual partners or becoming an extra sexual partner in the context of a formal marriage or not. Sex with a minor is also excluded. When we practice this, our partner gains trust in us, does not need to feel jealous, and need not fear the financial hardship and emotional distress that would come with the breakup of the family. This precept has, by the way, nothing to do with the perceived kinkiness that might adhere to sexual acts according to societal norms, which between consenting adults is not generally harmful. 4. I undertake the precept to refrain from false speech. This prohibits lying, which undermines trust and social harmony and is implicated in many forms of exploitation. We practice this so that others have accurate information on which to base their decisions, even when our impulse might be to misdirect their decisions in our own favor. 5. I undertake the precept to refrain from the heedlessness of spirits, liquor, and intoxicants. This precept is unlike the others in that the harm otherwise committed is less certain and less immediate. In fact, no definable harm might result in a particular case of violating this precept. Nonetheless, imbibing alcohol is implicated statistically in car accidents or presumably ox, cart, or chariot misadventures in the Buddha's day, barroom brawls, spouse abuse, family neglect, and mental illness. The sharp and heedful mind is not only highly prized in Buddhism, but also fundamental to purity of mind, the topic of upcoming talks, with all of its ethical implications. The standard set of precepts cover 5 basic pitfalls whereby harm occurs. Some people choose a higher level of practice commitment by adding some more finely tuned precepts. Common are the following two, both like the fourth precept having to do with proper speech. First, I undertake the precept to refrain from harsh speech. Harsh language injures the one we are speaking to and leads to disharmony in human relations. And second, I undertake the precept to refrain from malicious speech. The word malicious already tells us that harm is intended. This is speech that, even when it's truthful, is intended to create divisions and animosity. These additional precepts having to do with speech will be discussed in future talks on harmony. Buddhists have commonly, from the earliest days, observed an extended set of precepts beyond the basic five, including these last two, specifically on Uposatha days, that is, every quarter moon, just to push the envelope of practice a bit. Since most listeners will be somewhat familiar with Judeo-Christian commandments, let me make a few contrasts to draw out some peculiar qualities of Buddhist precepts. Precepts pertain, at least in early Buddhism, to actions of body and speech, but not thought. Commandments, on the other hand, seem sometimes to apply to thought, such as coveting our neighbor's house, cow, or wife. Thoughts, as a matter of ethics, fall in Buddhism in much more sophisticated detail under purifying mind. Although thoughts, along with bodily and verbal actions, are a kind of kamma, their mental actions, thoughts are much more difficult to bring under control and therefore require wielding something more refined than a practice rule. Precepts are taken on in Buddhism entirely as trainings. The Pali word for precept, sikkhapada, means literally training step. That is, they're undertaken voluntarily as part of a personal practice commitment, rather than as an imposition by God, Pope, government, or other authority. In this sense, there is no sin in Buddhism, whereas violating a commandment in Christianity or in other Abrahamic faiths insults the will of God, precepts simply reflect a duty to oneself and to the world. Although precepts and commandments widely overlap in content, the difference noted entails that one can logically break a commandment without doing or intending harm, or observe a commandment while doing and intending harm. For God's will can work in mysterious ways that we know not of. Murder, theft, bearing false witness, and adultery are actions both harmful to others and displeasing to God. Homosexual acts, on the other hand, making for ourselves an idol or handling leather made from pigskin, would seem rather harmless. We say that they're victimless crimes, but nonetheless, so we are told in the Old Testament, are displeasing to God. Stoning someone to death is clearly harmful to others and clearly violates the first Buddhist precept, yet might be sanctioned by God as an appropriate response to others' misdeeds, never in Buddhism. As a practical consequence of the absence of sin, we rarely find victimless crimes in early Buddhist ethics. In fact, the Buddhist precepts are to a surprising degree free of cultural norms and quite relevant to this day. The strength and limitations of precepts. Precepts provide the most primitive and concise form within the three kinds of ethics, generosity, harmlessness, and purity. Their primary advantage is that they provide reasonably clear guides to conduct, even when we're drawing a blank and cannot work out all the consequences of a proposed action. This reduces much of our conduct to rules of thumb that are easy to learn and remember, even for the young or young at heart, or for the beginning Buddhist, or for one with beginner's mind. A precept tends to highlight a basic problem area in human conduct that the sages of past ages must have experienced and recognized. The weaknesses of precepts as guides to ethical conduct are that they generally allow loopholes and they don't permit appropriate exceptions. That is, precepts are porous and rigid. There is the case in which the Gestapo shows up at our front door and asks us, gleefully aware that a Buddhist will not lie, if we are hiding Jews in the attic, or the case in which one of us just happens to be returning from a softball game with bat in hand and walk in right behind a man who has just gone postal with an assault rifle that he is about to unload on his fellow employees. There are, moreover, many harmful behaviors that simply are not covered in precepts, like taking up two parking places or telling dull stories. Nonetheless, it's significant that the Buddha rarely sanctioned exceptions to precepts to correct their rigidity. I suspect this is because he wanted us to be fully aware of and live with the contradictory nature of the human condition, rather than regulate it away. The one example I'm aware of in which the Buddha discusses the kinds of contradictions that may arise in following precepts is in the 38th Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha was challenged for his own use of harsh speech, of all things, against Devadatta, his misguided cousin, who had, one, created a schism in the Sangha, two, had injured the Buddha in an assassination attempt, three, had induced a prince to murder his father in order to become king, and four, had committed various other odious misdeeds. The Buddha's response was that sometimes it's necessary to dig a pebble out of a child's mouth, even though it causes great discomfort, providing a metaphor for choices we must sometimes make rather than admitting loopholes was wise. Given the smallest loophole, many people will become quite creative in finding exceptions to precepts. For instance, soon disregarding non-harming in the case of people one does not like, or for whoever is otherwise imagined to be undeserving. Kamma and its fruits. We learned in previous talks that kamma means volitional action and that it is closely related to merit-making, but that more generally all Buddhist practice is kamma. A generous act is kamma, a harmful act is kamma. Following a precept is kamma. Breaking a precept is kamma. Furthermore, sitting down to meditate or fixing the mind on the breath is kamma, for kamma can be of body, speech, or mind. I'd like to go into some more depth with respect to the critical concept of kamma here, and then even more depth in subsequent talks. The violation of precept is always karmic, that is, although it must involve a physical act of speech or body, it also requires mental intention. For instance, accidentally running over the neighbor's cat or inadvertently taking someone else's suitcase does not violate a precept against killing living beings or stealing because it lacks volition. Also, violating a precept entails demerit, whereas performing a generous action entails merit. Now, the term kamma originally meant simply action. However, it's worth noting that the Brahmanic religious tradition had, by the time of the Buddha, long used this word in a specialized sense to capture the key concept of ritual action, where rituals were supposed to determine the future well-being of the person on whose behalf the ritual was conducted by a Brahmin priest. A properly performed ritual, often an animal sacrifice with some incantations of memorized texts, was good kamma. An improperly performed ritual was bad kamma. For the Brahman, kamma equals action plus ritual. For the Buddha, on the other hand, every intentional action that we perform has this solemn role as a determinant of the actor's future well-being, for no one can intercede on our behalf through ritual in this way. Moreover, the benefit for us is found not in the ritual quality, but in the ethical quality of our actions. That ethical quality is inherent in our intentions, roughly whether we intend harm or benefit to others, or whether we are instead motivated by desire for personal advantage. For the Buddhist, kamma equals action plus intention. Kamma in Buddhism is explicitly defined as volitional action, and intention is as sacred for the Buddhist as ritual is for the Brahmin, and therefore must be carefully deliberated, just as ritual action must be for the Brahmin priest. We, in modern culture, generally differentiate between benefit or harm for others and benefit or harm for ourselves, and think of ethical conduct as a balancing act between the two. The Buddha, in contrast, equated the two, saying, I will be the heir of whatever deeds, good or bad, that I do. In short, our karmic acts not only shape the world for others, but also shape our personal fortune. Good deeds work to our own benefit as well as to the benefit of others. Bad deeds work against our own benefit as well as against the benefit of others. The effect of one's own action accrued for oneself is called its karmic result, vipaka, or alternatively, its karmic fruit, phala. Likewise, we can talk about the results or fruits of practice. Without producing results, it would be fruitless to practice. So if I intentionally harm someone, it will be to my own detriment, and if I give generously to the benefit of another, it will be to my own well-being. This seems like a bold generalization, but one that can be verified in our own experience and found to hold up quite well. For instance, we enjoy some of the fruit of a generous deed right away when it brings us joy. Moreover, others become a bit more well-disposed towards us, and we may benefit in the near future from their cooperation or support. After a lifetime of generosity, we die peacefully and without regret. In contrast, with the tension of anger or greed, we taste the bitter fruit of a malicious deed right away. Others become a bit more ill-disposed towards us, and we suffer when they refuse to cooperate with us or to support us in the near future. After a lifetime of harming others, we die in anguish and with remorse. As we explore our own experience, the bold generalization that the ethical quality of our kamma determines our own well-being, we are likely to note various factors conspiring to produce that result. Our harmful actions tend to incite retribution to our detriment from those affected because people tend by nature to be vengeful. Moreover, the more we act in this way, the more we develop dispositions to act this way, and eventually we become trapped in dispositions that repeatedly produce unfortunate results. Such dispositions define our character. Our angry or greedy disposition gives rise to loneliness because people tend also not to like those of angry or greedy disposition and therefore distance themselves from them. Soon we view the world as determined to torment us. Habitual anger and other unwholesome mental factors are demonstrably associated with physical health problems. Even physical beauty adheres to ethical character, Kind people often exhibit a kind of angelic glow, where hateful people often seem perpetually under a cloud with furrowed brow. Through our kamma, we are quite capable of creating a personal hell right here on earth or a heaven. Very specific examples of the fruition of kamma may raise the skeptical reader's eyebrows, such as offering a certain worthy monk alms on one occasion in one life and then receiving great riches for oneself in the next life. Such examples of karmic cause and specific effect are actually relatively rare in the earliest texts and could be entirely allegorical. Exactly how and why karmic acts produce their results according to ethical quality in this way is not explicitly clarified by the Buddha, nor is it necessary to know. We need only to verify this generalization in our own experience and make use of it. In any case, it doesn't require some kind of mysterious cosmic accounting mechanism, something like Santa keeping track of who is naughty and nice, which I emphasize, lest we dismiss the notion altogether. In fact, practical, psychological, physiological, and sociological processes in themselves seem adequately to motivate virtually all of the claims about karmic fruits. We will investigate karma primarily in psychological terms in the future talks on purity. Moreover, I should note a common misunderstanding about karma that may also mystify the critically thinking listener. This is that everything that happens to us for our benefit or harm necessarily has a previous karmic basis, that is, as fruits of our own actions. For instance, the assumption that winning the lottery or being blown away by a tornado must be the fruit of some generally indeterminate past deed. This misunderstanding, very widely accepted in many modern schools of Buddhism, is in fact unambiguously denied by the Buddha in the Sivaka Sutta. Quite simply, there are many causal factors at work in the world in addition to karma, and we are subject to most of them. If a tree's roots have rotted, a gust of wind can fell the tree. If the tree falls where we stand, entirely through no karmic fault of our own, we're likely to be injured. Previous kamma is beside the point in explaining this eventuality. More important than understanding the mechanisms that produce karmic fruits is understanding why the Buddha taught kamma and the fruits of kamma. The Buddha was characteristically not interested in speculative philosophy, nor in science in the sense of unearthing the universe's hidden mechanisms. Rather, his teaching is intended as a determinant of our practice, which in turn is a determinant of our personal development, hopefully in the direction of perfect virtue, perfect wisdom, and perfect serenity. Our practice is kamma, and each of the hundreds of intentional actions we perform throughout the day is a factor in determining our developmental progress. Therefore, it's imperative to take great care in what we choose to do, including gaining merit where we can, and by all means remaining harmless. This is what the teachings around kamma bring to our practice. ¶¶